Broadcasting live from the Business Radio X studios in Phoenix, Arizona, it's time for Phoenix Business Radio, spotlighting the city's best businesses and the people who lead them.
Welcome to the Mind Money Motion program, where we focus on worrying less about money by keeping our mind and body healthy. I'm your host, Marie Burns, a certified financial planner, speaker, author, and founder of the education business called Mind Money Motion. My guests will help you improve your mind by maintaining a positive, active brain, your money by learning to use money wisely as a tool, and your motion by incorporating healthy diet and exercise habits, all so you can enjoy less worry and more life. I want to thank my co-sponsor, the Women's Enterprise Foundation, for helping to make this program possible. The Women's Enterprise Foundation is a 501c3 charitable organization that supports and inspires women business owners. They believe that women are the glue for their communities because they participate in, orchestrate, and mediate relationships, opportunities, and business growth. So they offer grants and scholarships to assist women business owners like myself in the Phoenix area. I'm excited to welcome my guests today. We have two guests in the studio, Lupe Camargo, financial planner at Perspective Financial Services. She's been a financial planner for over 15 years, has her MBA from the University of Texas, is certified, and has conducted boot camps on behavior change to create stronger financial and health habits. We're going to come back to that. And my other guest is Elena Z, the president and CEO of the Arizona Council on Economic Education. She's been in the global financial services industry for over 20 years, has a dual bachelor's degree in both econ and math, as well as a master's in economics from Columbia University. She's taught both financial planning and economics at the university level and has represented the city of Phoenix multiple times in China for cultural, education, tourism, and business exchanges. And again, talking about this later, recently appointed to the Arizona Financial Literacy Task Force. Welcome, both of you, and thank you for joining me today.
Thank you, Marie.
Thank you, Marie.
The question, or the statement, I should say, I'd like to throw out there to get our discussion started is probably one many of us have heard before, and I think it's good news when we hear it. And it's that financial success is 20% head knowledge and 80% behavior. So I know, Lupe, you have some behavior change boot camp background. So I'm curious, what started your passion and involvement with that whole behavior change aspect?
Thanks, Marie. You know, it started for me probably about 3 years ago as I was approaching a milestone birthday. So I was going to be turning 50, and it really forced me to think about what are the things in my life that I'm not happy with? You know, what are the things that I wanted to change? And for me, it was my health. You know, I'm a financial planner, so I sort of had the money thing sort of figured out. My education and career were on a good track, but my health was not. And, you know, and I think the hard part for me was that there were several attempts in the past to make those changes, and I had failed. I'm like, why is it? Why is this so difficult when I've had success in other parts of my life? You know, the one thing I realized before I sort of went down the journey was how, well, let me back up. I heard a quote, which I love. It's like, our world is perfectly organized to give us the life that we're experiencing. So it really forced me to think about the design of my life. And that was sort of like the first, for me, realization that I need to do this differently because my life needs to be organized in a very different way. And so I went down a different path, and I can talk about that later, but I went down a different path, but 10 months later, I lost 50 pounds. Ooh. Yeah, it was, and you know, this, the bizarre thing, and I think what, the outcome delighted me. I was really, really excited about the change in the outcome, but there were two other big changes that happened that made it effortless and seamless for me. One, the change in my systems and the way I designed my life. So the change in my behavior and systems change, but also my identity changed. I went from thinking of myself as someone that wanted to be healthy to someone that was an athlete. And when I started changing the focus of who, not just what I wanted to change, but who I wanted to become, became a much bigger driver. So it kind of, I think it started me down a road where I became fascinated with the idea that there's so many things that people want to change in their life. And sometimes it's very, very difficult. And most of the time it's difficult. People go, I mean, there's statistics that show people go through 7 to 12 efforts before they actually, you know, find success. And, you know, you think about New Year's resolutions, where people make resolutions, most people lose them in a couple of months. So what is it? What is it that makes successful people, or what is it that make people successful in their behavior change attempts? Because you can have two people that want the same thing, but one gets it and one doesn't. So it really isn't just about wanting it. It's about designs and systems in your life and really identifying who is it that you want to be. And I think realizing that for me, I had to deconstruct what, honestly, when I reached the goal, it really made me just sort of sit back and think, what the heck just happened? I just achieved a goal that I had struggled so long to attain. And it was so easy. Like, what was it that happened that was so easy? And honestly, I didn't know. I didn't understand. So that started me down a path where I was just fascinated with what research is out there, and including neuroscience, that drives us to achieve the things we want to achieve. And as a financial planner, I think I have clients that may struggle with saving more, investing more. Beyond just being a financial planner and helping them manage their money, what else can I do to coach them through those difficult behaviors? And so I just think that, especially after having gone through it myself, in doing these boot camps, I'm fascinated with this idea, because not only can you serve yourself, but I was motivated. I wanted to serve my clients. I wanted to serve my family. I wanted to serve all the people around me to help and support their change efforts. So I know it's kind of a long answer to your question, but I think it has put me down a path where I am just really passionate about understanding it and understanding how to make it easier for people.
Well, when you, that 50-year-old, you know, milestone for many of us is a stop and think about where has my life been and where is it going, is very common. But then to actually be able to be so successful, I mean, 50 pounds, that's huge. And in 10 months, and then to keep it off. So what would you say is, why is it so hard for people to make those changes? You obviously did it. What was it that flipped the switch that made the change possible for you?
That's a great question. And I think to answer it, it has to sort of start with the brain. You know, I think what I've come to realize is the way we are wired is for survival. So the brain, you know, that when you want to make these kinds of changes in your life, you use a lot of your prefrontal cortex, which is, you know, 10% of what we use of our brain. It takes a lot of energy. So the brain doesn't like change. It takes a lot of calories and energy. So we're trying to jump into action and make changes in our life, and our brain is saying, whoa, way too much. You need to give up. And so what you do to get around that is make it easier for the brain. And how do you make it easier for the brain? You design a system that sort of moves the things that you want into a different part of your brain that stores habits. And so really it's creating behaviors and designing the habits that are going to be stored in a different part of your brain. Because if your brain had to think about everything all the time, it would be really difficult. So you have to put certain behaviors in the part of your brain that can habitualize it, so then you could save the space for other more important things. So there were a lot of different things that happened. And I think for me, the identity piece was very huge. I think it's, you know, who do I want to become, I think was really important. And I wanted to also be a role model for my daughter. I get a little choked up when I think about that. But knowing that was a big driver because you really have to know what your why is. I think another really critical thing that I just overlooked in all my past attempts is how there are several influences around you that dictate whether you're successful or not. One is your personal motivation and your personal ability. Like, do I even have the skills to know what to do? Right? That's an important piece. And that's where a lot of, you know, my clients come to me because I can be that skill set that they don't have. So identifying that for me, I found a coach that gave me that information. The second piece is the social aspect is, what am I surrounding myself with? And I think a lot of the times we fall into situations where we think the people that are around us all the time need to be the people that are going to coach us through. But those aren't necessarily the right people. I mean, they can love you. And, you know, I think of, you know, like my husband, you know, he's got, you know, we've got our world, you know, moving in a different direction. But I think that sometimes we need to have a different tribe or a different population to get us going, because we need to find the people that have already created habits that are normal to them, so they can become normal to us.
Sure.
And I found that tribe, that exercise community tribe. So all of a sudden, oh my God, these people are meal prepping every Sunday for 2 hours. I've not done that in a long time. That is now normal for me. These people are exercising 5 times a week. Unheard of. Now it's normal to me. So you cannot discount your environment. And I think the other piece. So there's the personal, there's the social, and there's the environment. The environmental design is probably the most critical one, because I think a lot of the times when people want to make changes, they start in the hardest place, and that's the personal motivation. You know, you hear it all the time, all these self-help books that say, you got to want it really, really hard. Well, I don't think that's true anymore. Like my philosophy now is, why start in the hardest place? Because that's where your brain is going to resist the most. Start in the easiest place, your environment, you know? Right. Have the right triggers, right, in your environment.
Right. Let me come back to that motivation, because you're right. That's a whole subject area within itself. But you're saying a couple of things. So the whole money thing, as we said, is partially where we are today is often based on where we were as a child, growing up, right, our experiences. And what I'm excited about is, you know, trying to help others be in a better place than where you were, for example, or we are now, by having that more positive environment growing up. And so that's where, when people like Elena Z are involved with our children as a part of the target audience that's involved with your efforts, we are trying to not only educate, but make the environment the right and cool thing to do, is to be smart about our money and making those decisions. So Elena, I know the most recent thing that I'm curious myself to hear about is your involvement with this newly formed Arizona Financial Literacy Task Force. So if you can kind of tell us how that came about, maybe, and where you're, I know you have the children as an audience within that task force, but how else are we trying to educate our citizens on the money side of their life?
Yes, thank you, Marie. And Lupe, what you're sharing is just fascinating. And my husband is in the mental health. He's a mental health therapist. So the behavior change and relating it to my world of economics, and I always say, people respond to incentives, and when they have the goals and they know why they need to change or take actions, and their incentives that they can see, they do the right things. So, and with our children, now a little bit background about myself, I grew up actually in China back in the 1960s and 70s, a very different period of time. I didn't grow up with any laundry machine, no cars. So very, very basic. So survival was the goal. And I remember listening to you, Lupe, And I was thinking about the power of intention. And when I was 14 years old, we were living in this village outside of Shanghai. I remember my birthday party, and I said to my mother, I said, I want to work on Wall Street one day. She looked at me just like I'm crazy. I think that I saw movies and photos and The Better Life. That's what I wanted. And so what I responded to and making plans to get there. Then when I started working at American Express in New York, I remember thinking that, well, I want to travel the world. And I want to have a job that will enable me to do that. And that's what I ended up doing for 15 years and worked for them and worked in many countries. So coming back to financial education with our children, and one thing I find is very interesting and comparing China, where I grew up, and the United States, is there's just abundance of choices here. In the U.S. And with more choices, it comes with more responsibilities. And people need to have more information and education in order to choose responsibly. And I think that's a sign of a more developed economy, that in a underdeveloped economy, you don't have as many choices. So I think financial education is a sign of a developed economy, a mature, free market. So it was surprising to me that financial education was not part of academic discipline in the U.S. And so Arizona Council on Economic Education was established actually back in the 1970s. By a group of educators who thought this discipline is so important, why is it missing in the classrooms? So they started working together and developed lessons, activities to use and share with other teachers to use in the classrooms. So that's how it got started. And now we have a network of 13,000 teachers statewide. So we still have a very long way to go. And the state treasurer, our new state treasurer, Kimberly Yee, is very passionate about financial education. And she had her personal stories to share. And this is one of her office top priorities. The task force met. It's a member of, I think, 14 members representing very diverse. And we quickly realized that there are different populations need to be served in financial education. So the task force now has three committees addressing different populations. And I am on the kindergarten to high school throughout college, so including the emergent adults population and so the youth population, the young adults. The second committee is veterans and the senior citizens. And we have members serving on that committee. And the third committee is vulnerable populations and families. So we're each working on we're each researching at the moment and to identify the top priorities that we want to work on.
Excellent. Well, so the youth is K-12 or K, whatever we 16. Call college, 16.
Yeah.
And now I recall that Arizona earlier this year passed a law requiring personal finance be part of the high school graduation requirement.
Right.
And so there's a curriculum that they need to learn X, Y, Z before they graduate. And is that typically incorporated at the junior, senior level of high school?
So we now have economics, financial literacy standards to be taught. And now, I want to I want to say Arizona is a local control state when it comes to education. So the state legislature or the board does not dictate the curriculum to be used to meet the standards. The board, the Arizona Department of Education sets the standards and objectives need to be taught. The school districts decide what curriculum, what lessons to use to teach. So the new mandate, now it is codified by law that prior to high school graduation, every student must have financial literacy class. It's part of the economics class right now. We still have a long way to go, but it's a starting point.
Yes, you have to start somewhere. And then the whole motivation aspect that we started talking about, as far as how do you get motivated or can motivation be taught? I'm curious if there's an overlap there with what the standards are providing as far as what's required subject-wise. But then you mentioned incentives and intentions to help students. And I'm sure you have some teacher stories as to how it goes in the classroom, what they really are surprised kids don't know, or what they seem to most latch on and want and need. So maybe, Lupe, if you can talk about the motivation piece first, and then Elena, I'll ask you to translate that into what you have been seeing happens in the classroom.
I love the fact that this is becoming a sort of state mandate. I think it's so, so critical. You know, I have a daughter, and I remember, when I think back about the things that were most impactful in just, you know, financial education, is educating her on the influences, external influences that especially kids are absolutely not aware of.
So consumerism, right?
Consumerism, yes. And so, you know, I'm in a really interesting place because I had a background in marketing prior to becoming a planner. So I know what's being taught to marketers on what to do to influence human behavior. So I'm very, very sensitive to that. And I think when it comes to encouraging children to make better choices, it's really great to shed the light to them that we live in a world that is not encouraging us to make the right decision. I think that's really, really critical, because there are, you know, you think about bad habits that form, they usually start with a trigger, right? Trigger, the habit loop is there's a trigger or cue that results in a response or a habit, and then there's a reward in the end, and it, you know, keeps looping through that. Well, and I'll give you a perfect example. I had a client of mine that was saying she was overspending and she didn't understand why. And so we sort of went back and helped her increase her awareness of what were the habits. Well, I open up my email, I check my email, and oh, then I get an email from my favorite retailer or Groupon. And all of a sudden, I'm on Groupon and I'm buying something. You know, I think that it's really quite incredible, but it's getting easier and easier to become disconnected with our purchasing behaviors. And lo and behold, all of these daily habits result in really bad, bad outcomes. And I think with children, sometimes it's good to shed the light that there are negative forces working against you in securing your financial future. I think that's just as important as understanding all the other, you know, components of financial education.
Yeah. That whole aspect of buying and saving and income and spending, I'm sure, is what you're seeing in the classroom.
Yes, and it goes back to the economic way of thinking. And so we always say that financial literacy education, it's not just about dollars and cents. It's the way of thinking. So we teach, for example, the concept of opportunity cost, that every time you make a decision, there is a cost. And many children and even adults don't realize that. They believe that I can make a decision. I can have the cake and eat it too. I mean, really, it is so understanding and being very conscious of every time we make a decision, we're giving up something else. And there is no free lunch. So, and I remember we had this class with a group of 6, 7 year olds. And at the end of the class, we were asking them, so what did you learn? What was the one most important lesson you learned today? And this boy, 6 year old, he said, I learned that if I spend it today, I won't have it tomorrow. I mean, literally.
Wow.
That.
Yay.
Just he got it. Yes. And it is just that, that resources are scarce. And, so knowing that, having the economic way of thinking, knowing that nothing is for free. Every time we make a decision, it making decisions is very hard, and it's a responsibility.
I love that. And you know, just the one other thing to add is somehow I think because we've got so much that is bombarding our brain, we stop paying attention. We stop paying attention to all of these things. You know, what we're spending, what we're doing, what we're not doing, and I think sort of stopping and just realizing that we need to focus on, or we need to understand when we're headed down a path that is not going to get us where we need to be. I think that's an important piece too.
Well, and like you said, with the marketing background, our country is measured on consumerism.
Absolutely.
Right? How much Absolutely. Are we buying is our indicator that our country is doing well. Yikes.
Right.
So I know this is already happening somewhere, but the whole concept of look how easy it is now to not have cash.
Right.
And Absolutely. You swipe and then there's Apple Pay and you don't even have to take out the card. You just have your phone. I believe there are stores already in the country and maybe in other countries where you literally go into the store and as long as you have your phone on you, you can take your items. And as you walk out, it's all scanned and withdrawn from your bank account. No swiping, no stopping at the cash register, no cashier needed.
I experienced that in Seattle. It was at an Amazon store where nothing, you just register the app on your phone, you walk in, you walk out, and you're done.
Yeah.
You know, there's a trade-off, right? We're trading off ease of transactions to this complete disconnected world where we've lost touch, you know, and I think when people come to me and say, what are some of the things for me to get reconnected? The first thing I tell them is pay with cash. Pay with cash. Then you'll really understand and see how fast you burn through it.
Yeah. We do this question of the day activity with students at the beginning of each class during the bell work. And one question of the day is, Gen Z, which is 14 to 21 year old, how many of them, percentage of them use mobile app to make payments? And the answer is 48%. So half of them. And it is higher risk or lower risk? And the answer is it's higher risk of overspending. So when it becomes so easy to...
The less painful it is,
right?
The more likely they are to purchase without thinking, without having any awareness of the opportunity cost. Yes. Dangerously easy.
Absolutely.
Is what marketing is doing.
Right.
Yes.
So true.
Yeah.
Well, the awareness there is huge. And that's part of what the curriculum, I'm sure at the K-16 level, is creating the awareness so they realize and then talk about or are given a chance to practice those saving, spending, investing types of opportunities.
Yeah. And we do start with talking about the power of intention and incentives and start with what kind of life do you want to live? And we ask middle school students, high school students, what kind of life do you want? And so they will say, and we have, we actually developed this app with the support of the Federal Reserve Bank of San Francisco. And so the students can put in, I want to own a house. I want to have a nice car. I want to have gym membership. I want to have vacation. And they put all that in and they see the number. This is how much it costs. And so in order to have this type of lifestyle, how much money do you need? So they go backwards and then the reality kicks in. Oh, I need to get a better education. I need to work harder in school and I need to get new skills. So
do you see this as a math concept, math subject area to be tying all of this in? Because we know math is required and everybody knows they're going to learn math. So is that where financial literacy is also?
So I think, thank you for the question,
yes.
Marie. Financial literacy is an awesome application of math, the calculation of net worth. You can do graphing, you can do charts and to see the asset allocation and ratio calculation. But financial education, it's not math. It's critical thinking. It's that economic way of thinking, and it's equally important. It's a formal academic discipline, just like any other discipline, like reading, writing, and math, that we need to implement in the schools, which I don't think we're there yet. When we survey former students, parents, teachers, anyone, over 90% of them say financial education must be taught in school, and it is number one, number two most important subject. Yet, when it comes to implementation, that we often ignore what is needed to have good education, assessment, teacher preparation. And somehow, when it comes to financial education, we're trying to find the shortcuts that maybe we don't need assessment. Maybe we don't need well-prepared teachers. Maybe we don't need the funding to support it. And we can just, you know, teach it here and there. And that doesn't work. I think that until financial literacy education is respected and regarded as a formal academic discipline, like reading, writing, math, history, we're not going to make progress.
And
it's
yet,
very interesting.
We all are, you know, on the same page that financial literacy is a life skill.
Absolutely.
No matter what industry or profession or socioeconomic background you are in, it's money is a tool you're going to need to know how to use wisely throughout your entire life, no matter where you live, what you do. So I know we're all in agreement that it seems foreign to not think of it as maybe it's the fourth R, reading, writing, arithmetic, and whatever we want to name it, but it's financial education.
Real life.
Yes, real life.
Yeah, I think that's such a great point. And I think, you know, one of the things I'm curious about, Elena, when you have the curriculum in the classroom, does it engage the families of the children? Because I feel like, especially when you're young, the environment is so critical because that is when you develop the money scripts that end up dictating what you do as an adult. And, you know, my personal background, I didn't talk about money with my parents very often. It was something that I had to sort of seek out on my own. And I think a lot of the times parents don't think about that. I had a daughter I sent off to college and we had a full conversation about, you know, what this means to her. And I realized prior to that, you know, we probably could be doing this more often and more regularly. Now we do. But I'm curious to see if there's family involvement in the education.
Yeah. Family involvement is so important in education in general, period, regardless of what is being taught. And there is research to show how important family involvement can improve the education outcome. And for financial literacy, absolutely. And now what's unfortunate is that many children, they learn from their parents. The family environment help them to develop that discipline of saving and making better choices. But many students don't have that. And so in So again, education, it just levels the playing field to make sure that every student gets that opportunity of financial education and making better decisions.
I know I was taking a look at the standards just to get an idea of what all do they learn at the various grade levels. Yeah. And it was really encouraging to see that it's all related to, again, real life. They're going to understand that income is often related to their education, their work experience, their job skills. So going back to what kind of life do you want and how do I get to that? Well, your income can be impacted by choices, spending, budgeting, interest rates as it relates to saving and the impact of inflation on, you know, future purchasing. Credit is another area that they touch on, in addition to, I think, the one most people assume is investing. And that is in there as well, investing and realizing that to take more risk is how you get more reward. But you also have to recognize and be okay with that. And then they address diversification. So that was good to hear as well as a CFP. And then the whole protecting ourselves from loss of things like health and income, or these days identity. So the whole risk management insurance aspect. So nice round subject areas under the financial education. I was glad to see that.
That's fantastic. I would imagine too that you may have children that take that information back to their families, right? The child becomes the influencer to the parents, I would imagine.
It does happen. It's happening now. The children are teaching their parents about better spending and saving decisions. So we see this, happening more and more. And it is great. And the new standards, I think it's very intentional to make the financial education with that critical thinking and having the decisions and thinking through the whys. So it's not just a math calculation. It involves a lot of the whys. It brings in the current affairs, current events into the teaching. And I was a math major in college. And yet I had the opportunity to, I was living in New York City and I had an opportunity to purchase this apartment. I was already working full time and I didn't because I was so fearful of having a mortgage. And it just seems such a mystery to me. So I was the opposite, that for some is overspending, right? Incurring a lot of debt. For me, I was just petrified about having any debt or mortgage, and, you know, owning a home is such a mystery. And had I had a financial education in high school, that basic knowledge would have helped me better.
Well, and that goes back to what you were or weren't familiar with as a child growing up in the environment you were in, which also ties into your money scripts. How do we get money scripts? Mm-hmm. It's that whole children are sponges and they absorb what they hear and feel and learn in their environment. But then if you could talk a little bit more about the money scripts aspect,
sure.
Because the education falling on the ears of one type of money personality versus another is going to have two different results.
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, I'm going to tell you a little story about one of my clients, and I think this is a great way to illustrate a money script. I had a personal friend slash client that was, you know, just sort of making it, barely making it with her husband. She had two children. And she, in the course of, well, she had came to me and she said, I just discovered that I've inherited a lot of money. So a money-changing amount, a life-changing amount of money. And so I met with her attorney, the attorney that contacted her, and when she found out what she had inherited, I remember sitting in on that meeting, she started to cry. And after the meeting, I said, why are you so upset? And I'll never forget her response. She said, because I am not good with money. That was the money script that she had made. And I know that if it's up to me, I'm going to blow it. And I have an opportunity to change my family's life, and I'm going to blow it. that I'm not good with money script in her mind was so embedded that it was just petrifying her. And what we discovered, you know, over time is that how do you change that? You know, how do you, it's your identity, it's your money script. And so, you know, how we changed it over time is you do it bit by bit, small habit by small habit. That's how you end up changing that money script, changing that identity. And that's what we did with her. I was teaching her behaviors that people that are good with money do. And she started doing these behaviors. And as she, as that became a bigger part of her habits and of her routine, she started changing that identity. She started changing that money script. So, you know, Marie, you're absolutely right. Like, you have to acknowledge where you've come from and what those money scripts are. Like you said, Elena, like you had the money script that debt is evil, you know, like debt is evil. And it's, you know, what's it going to change? What's it going to take to change that? Is that it's really going to be the small little things that we do, the habits and what we tell ourselves that will change our identity, that will really change our money scripts for the better. So yeah, and everybody walks in with different money scripts. One other story, I had a client that came into my office that said, I have never been good with money. I can't solve this problem. I need to surround myself with people that are good with money. So at least he acknowledged that he didn't have it within him to make that change and sought out advice or sought out information. And I thought that was really valuable.
Elena, I would imagine you've heard teachers that have heard the money scripts come out of students' mouths. What they heard, what they were told, how they feel because of oftentimes things they cannot control.
Yeah, yeah. Students who are taught by their parents not to have a bank account, that they don't trust banks. And so that's a cultural thing. It's so deep-rooted. And so that takes some education. And that there is a lot to think about that.
Yeah, I think it really goes back to taking the time to reflect and be aware, because I think those money scripts are constantly running through our brain and we're completely disconnected from them. I think about it too, even when you're married and your spouse may have money scripts that can really destroy a relationship. And unless you explore what those money scripts are, then I think it can be very problematic in relationships. And one of the questions that I think is always amazing and great for people to ask is, what was your first experience with money? Ask people, you know, what was your experience with money? I think that's a great way to start that conversation.
Yeah. What does money mean to you?
Absolutely.
And we try to give information to the students before they step into the real world. I'll never forget this story a teacher told me. It was a high school senior came to school crying. She was so excited. She got her first job and very excited. And then she came to school and crying that day and said, "Who is FICA? Took all my money, took so much of my money. Why? Who is FICA? Who is this FICA?"
I want his phone number.
You know, so they learned sooner or later. So we try to teach them as early on as possible and when it's applicable. And I had this long discussion about when is the best time. Right now, for most high school students, it's in their senior year, last semester of senior year, that the financial literacy is being taught. And I said, gosh, senior year, last semester, they checked out. You know, they
senioritis.
Want to go.
Senioritis,
right? So can we move it earlier, right? And so then we talk about, well, should it be freshman year, sophomore year? And we had discussion now, if it is too early, sometimes it may not be as effective. When it's closer, maybe junior year or first semester of senior year, that they start having a job And when, you know, when the real life application comes in, it may be the most effective time, but don't know what the right answer is, but that's something that we're discussing.
That teachable moment, right? You know, you talked about the money scripts and especially with couples. So each couple comes into a relationship with their own past history, baggage, money script, whatever you want to call it. There are, I read some research that there's three types of couples. And it's like any change, you have to start with an awareness of where you're at. One type of couple is called a driver and passenger. And I think of my parents. My dad was the driver. He took care of all things financial. And my mother was happy as a clam to be the passenger, know nothing, want to know nothing, because he was going to take care of it all. The second category is called the joined at the hip. They both talk about everything, are aware, but typically still one of them is the doer, takes care of all the paperwork, all the decisions. And the third couple is the divide and conquer couple. They talk about everything like the joined at the hip, but then they split the duties. And my husband and I have evolved that. He does the banking and the bill paying, and I do the investments and the insurance. But part of the comfort level of how did you get to the couple that you are, if you're in a couple relationship, is definitely the money script side of things. Well, how did you grow up? And what was money like in your family? And what kind of a couple maybe were your parents? So it's definitely a helpful starting point. But then like anything, when we recognize, okay, I need to make a change, and especially women, I encourage women to recognize statistically, we often outlive our spouse. And so we will be, even if we're the passenger now or the one in the joined at the hip couple that doesn't do, we're probably going to end up with that in our lap at some point. So it's helpful to make some changes now or at least be aware of things. So this whole behavior change, I'd like to kind of go back to the taking one bite at a time, mm-hmm. changing one habit at a time aspect so that our listeners can be thinking about, okay, I'm aware, I've identified. So are there environments I should be sure I'm setting up or typical next steps that will help me if you think of your boot camp, for example,
mm-hmm.
Lupe?
Mm-hmm. I think probably the first step that I would recommend to listeners is that be aware of what your current habits are. Like write down, like 40% of what we do is our habits, right? Because our brain doesn't want to use up too much energy. So make a list of those habits. And then next to that habit, put a positive or a negative. Is it helping you get where you need to be, or is it distracting you from where you need to be? I think that more than anything is the most important thing. And, you know, you really have to look, if you decide, I want to save more money, you have to identify what are the behaviors that are tied to that. So making sure that, well, again, the habit loop is making sure you have the right triggers in place, making sure that you make it easy. And talking about cutting it down into small pieces, like what are the small things that you can do? And there's a researcher out of Stanford, his name's BJ Fogg. He talks about the 2-minute rule. Like if you're going to start a new behavior, the rule needs to be you have to do it in 2 minutes. So if you want to maybe review your budget, look at it for 2 minutes, at least 2 minutes, because you need to tell your brain, this is going to be easy. I got this. No big deal. And really just make it 2 minutes because you need a gateway habit to start you down the path. So make it as easy as possible. For me, getting to the point where I was working out, I set out my clothes the night before as the trigger, and it was an easy thing to do. It really has to be easy. Otherwise, it's not going to happen. So really identifying what the desired behavior is and chunk it where it's really, really simple. And then start there.
Awesome. Mm-hmm. Elena, I'm curious with your financial literacy task force, like you said, so much education goes back to support or not in the home. So just as citizens listening, whether they're parents or grandparents or don't have children, how can we support and encourage positive financial education in this country and maybe in Arizona specifically?
Oh, God. So there's just so many. I think that with parents and grandparents, every day there are these moments when they go shopping, when the child's birthday is coming up, making a choice. And I have parents who told me that they literally would tell their child that I can give you this much cash or you can have your video game. And what would you rather have? You cannot have both. So I think infusing it to the day-to-day living would be helpful. And I was just contacted by City of Phoenix, the Family Resource Center, and they want to give some education resources to parents, grandparents with children from birth to five-year-olds. And I thought, wow, four-year-olds, five-year-olds, so young. And guess what? They're actually resources. They're songs. They're children's stories to help them learn about choices and resources and money and savings. So and make it into songs and stories. So that's on the family side. And then at school, we want financial education to be recognized and as a formal academic discipline. Don't just tell us it is important. It needs to be treated like any other subject. And let's not say that it is about balancing checkbooks. Mm. Half of our children, I mean, I think most of them have never even seen checks, let alone written a check. It's so much more than that. And prepare the teachers and support them. So.
Excellent. Thank you. Well, I know as I listen to things, and it's interesting, I heard some recent brain research that I'm going to kind of ignore, but I know our brains tend to typically focus on and grasp and remember three things. If we go over that, it's overwhelming and you get analysis paralysis and you don't learn anything. So as I'm listening today or anytime I'm trying to learn something from someone, I'm trying to identify kind of three key takeaways, three key messages. And so I've been listening as we're visiting, and I'd like to reflect back some of that to each of you and then have you add to that or correct maybe my hearing of what those three key takeaways are that might also be true for our listeners today, and then also share the best way to reach each of you in how you operate in your business with the whole financial education aspect of life. So Lupe, I'll start with you. And, you know, motivation is definitely a skill that we're agreeing can be built. But I think part of that one key takeaway to me was the reminder that today's marketing is absolutely not wanting us to make wise decisions. So motivated or not, be aware the deck is stacked against you from a consumer marketing standpoint, and we have to recognize that in order to break that habit loop and do the right thing. Another, I think, key message that you shared was that we can be successful in our changes by recognizing our brain is lazy. So we need to force it to do things that are still easy, but can be building new habits bit by bit, identifying ourselves, finding a coach, setting up our environment, but taking one bite at a time. So that was probably the third takeaway, is it's got to be all about how do you eat the elephant one bite at a time. I love that. Make a list of habits plus or minus after each one. Then you know where you might want to focus next, but just pick one and work on that one first.
Absolutely. No, I think that was great, Marie. That was great. I think the only other thing that I would like to add that I don't think I had mentioned is that You know, a lot of the times these daily habits, it takes time for them to take root and to really make a difference. So we need to be patient because they will pay off. So I think patience is very, very important. And we are all an experiment of one. So we need to play, learn, tweak, and keep adjusting. And I think as long as we don't give up, I think it's key. We need to be persistent.
Excellent. Awesome. And what is the best way for folks to reach you and learn more about your role at Perspective Financial Services?
Oh, thank you, Marie. Well, you can reach me. Our website is moneyaz.com. Easy to remember. M-O-N-E-Y-A-Z.com. If you want to email me directly, it's Lupe, L-U-P-E at moneyaz.com. You should be able to find me there on the website.
All right. Thank you. And Elena, so much here with your task force. It sounds like the best reminder I heard was the recognition for financial education and the task force is the fact that our country has so many choices. And it's about educating us to make wise choices. That whole economics approach, which I know is ingrained, and that's where this falls in the school system, which is great, is that opportunity cost is where we need to be aware when we're making our choices. So focusing on recognizing the opportunity cost as we're making choices. The whole citizen aspect, listeners, how can we support financial education? And I kept hearing you say critical thinking, critical thinking. So I loved your example of the shopping or the gift to a family member and setting up that opportunity to have the conversation. They won't recognize this is an opportunity cost conversation. I have this amount of money and here are my choices and what do I need to think about in buying that gift, excuse me, or shopping. And then lastly, the whole aspect that financial education really is about critical thinking and that we do need to recognize it in the law or amongst our family or in supporting our teachers, that is a skill that needs to be reckoned with.
That's great. That's great and spot on. And one thing I will add is, and have fun learning about money.
Excellent.
And we create curriculum, making it fun and relevant for the students to learn about money. So so that it won't become stressful for them. So
that's a great point because money is almost one of these taboo topics so often, isn't it? Nobody wants to talk about it. Nobody brings it up. And yet it's a life skill we need. Good. Thank you.
We can have fun learning.
Yes, absolutely. Great reminder. And best way to reach you, Elena?
Is our website. It's azecon.org. azecon.org.
Wonderful. Well, I can't thank you both enough for having this conversation today, and hopefully our listeners are feeling the same way. There's so much to talk about in these areas, but any little one takeaway that we can share that makes a difference in someone's life, I think is what my goal is with this program. So I want to thank our listeners for listening to this episode of Mind Money Motion, where we share how to worry less about money by taking care of our mind and body. Next month, our guests will be educating us and challenging us to incorporate healthier habits around the subject of loss. Maria Tomas-Keegan from Transition and Thrive with Maria will talk about the mind aspect of our focus. She'll talk about times when your world is shaken by a major life event and bouncing back feels impossible. So she's going to share how you can get back to your powerful, resilient self so you can make choices that help you to turn your upside-down world right side up again. And my other guest will be Heather Parker from the Parker Law Office, who will address the money aspect of loss from the standpoint of legal documents. She'll explain the various documents and what they do so you can plan ahead in order to make an already stressful time somewhat less traumatic. You can visit us at mindmoneymotion.com or find us on Facebook. Please join us next time for less worry, more life. I'm Marie Burns.